Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Fiat. Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com. And by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 294 for July 10th of 2015. The 2016 Nissan Maxima, the whole thing's controversial. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, Gary, here we are doing another show.
Here we are back in America.
Back in America. Well, we'll talk some later in the show about our trip to Germany.
Last week.
That was pretty interesting.
It was.
And we got to let everybody know we got Mark Phelan, the auto critic from the Detroit Free Press, with us. And it's great having you two.
Thank you, John.
Back here.
Pleasure.
Yeah. And, of course, we got to let everybody know, if you don't know already, I think you do, that we've got Vishnu Jamohan with Nissan Product Planning and Advanced Strategy. And he's got one of his babies in the studio with us here, too, the all-new Maxima.
Absolutely. So, thank you for having us on the show.
Yeah, Vishnu, tell us about this car. I mean, you know, everybody seems to be running to the crossover segment. You know, the sedan segment is shrinking. And yet you guys went ahead and did an all-new version of the Maxima. Why?
Great question. So sedans are shrinking depending on which segment you're looking at. If you look at traditional full-size sedans, there has been a little bit of contraction in that segment. But luckily for us, Maxima is a little bit different than those traditional full-size, be it your Avalons or your 300, Corsa 300s or your Impalas. It's a little bit more sportier. It's more, in terms of product concept, more like an entry luxury car. And in that sedan segment, you see a lot of growth. You see new entrants like Mercedes CLA, an Audi A3. You see a very resurgent Mercedes C-Class, a BMW 3 Series, a new all-new Acura TLX. So in that part of the segment, there's a lot of growth and a lot of heat. So we think that with this Maxima, we'll continue to do what we've done in the past, where we do cross-shop with those large sedan buyers looking for something a little bit more sporty. But we'll also pull in those entry-luxury folks, say, hey, I can save $5,000-$10,000 on my car, still get the same or more features, and still get a fun driving experience.
Mm-hmm. This is a big car, though. I mean, you guys have the Altima below that, and
correct,
now we have the Maxima above it. So who do you truly see as being the customer for this car versus somebody who might say, I think I'll get an Altima instead?
So versus an Altima, the customer? Somebody who really, one, has got a value style, right? I mean, if you look at the thing, it is very, 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 I would say, stands out quite a bit on the road, right? I mean, it's very dramatic. It's got, you know, it's got presence to it. And that doesn't always jive with an Altima customer. And that's the beauty of working on the Maxima project. It's just in general, you don't have to worry about pleasing, you know, 300,000 plus people a year in 60 different countries. You just got to worry about, you know, your Maxima customer base that really, you know, for one, right, that really likes that kind of dramatic style. They want to stand out a bit. Another thing is performance. You know, the car is designed to perform to a much higher level than an Altima. And the third thing is the interior. I think that's my personal favorite. It's just the execution of the interior itself is something that, sets it way apart from Altima. I'd say probably rivals some of the entry luxury sedans we're trying to go after.
And the U.S. is the biggest market for the Maxima.
Yes, by far, the U.S. is the biggest market. Second largest market is actually the Middle East. But we anticipate to do a lot more here than we will there. It's definitely a U.S.-centric car. And partly it's because it's the longest-running nameplate we have here. We've been in the market here for about 35 years, since 1980, with the model year 1981. As you probably remember, all of you remember, the 810, which became the 810 Maxima, which became the Maxima.
Hmm. Yeah,
in
that
fact,
was
isn't that part of the story that this is really an all-American car, right?
Yeah,
designed, engineered, manufactured in the U.S.
Designed, done primarily in San Diego in our design studio there. Engineering done right here in Farmington Hills, and functions like myself, product planning, located in Tennessee, and it's built in Tennessee as well.
And the design very clearly borrows from the new Murano. Is that something that the previous Murano also set the style for a generation of Nissan products? Is this an indication that we're going to see more cars that, you know, build on this look with the very flowing, you know, lines along the side, the new grille, that sort of thing?
Yeah, this is our design. We call this design language energetic flow, and I think you'll see this spread through our lineup, elements of this in various forms, right? Again, with an Altima, maybe not so aggressive, but elements of this, be it our V-Motion grille or our floating roof and so on, spread through various cars and crossovers in a lineup, just depending on the look and the appropriate look.
Renault just came out with a full-size sedan. I'm blanking out on the name.
Talisman.
Talisman.
But my understanding is, even though it's got essentially the same footprint,
right,
it's not at all using the same platform or anything?
Not to any of our knowledge. You know, I got a question from one of your brethren on this, and I said, this is the first time I have ever heard of the word Talisman coming from a Renault. So, no, the vehicles weren't designed in tandem. There is no relationship between the two other than we both happen to be working on full-size sedans.
So speaking of relationships, is there any relationship to the last generation Maxima with this new car?
In terms of platform or... Not really, no. This is a different platform.
Same engine.
Engine's the same displacement, but 60% of the parts are new. So, I mean, there's always, you know, small nuts and bolts or, you know, minor parts that carry over. But even things like the AC compressor and the AC HVAC units are all new. I mean, things that we could have carried over that nobody would notice. But all those components, since the old one came out in 2008, and since that time frame, a lot of those things have been redesigned for lighter weight or more efficiency and so on and so forth.
And this has got the latest version of your CVT. I'm embarrassed to admit, I don't remember if the previous Maxima had a CVT or if it was still a stepped gear.
The previous one had a CVT as well.
Okay.
And then this one's a new generation of that CVT.
And you've tuned it, you know, so that it, you know, gives you a lot of variability to go toward the sporty character that you want, right?
Correct, yeah. So basically, it's almost like having two different tunings. At low throttle inputs, you're driving around town, puttering around. It's like a normal CVT, which at low throttle inputs is you know, the behavior is very desirable, less shift shock and so on. However, at high throttle inputs, it starts to perform step shifts. And orally, we find, obviously, customers and enthusiasts like yourself alike find that to be more pleasing and more appealing. So that's what this does.
Yeah, don't be embarrassed, Mark. I couldn't remember if the old one had a CVT or not. I'm really interested that Nissan really has stuck with CVTs and made so many improvements over the years. Both this car, which I've driven briefly, and the Murano really impressed me because the Murano being a bigger, heavier vehicle and all-wheel drive available, you know, with a 3.5-liter V6, making all that work with a CVT is really impressive.
Yeah, you know, when it comes to CVTs, you know, we probably, let's say, in terms of mass production, one of the first manufacturers, right, with the 2007 Altima, really putting it into to big, large-scale numbers. But what's interesting is we've seen some of our crosstown brethren follow suit as well with the Honda and their Civic and the Accord and SCRV. They've implemented CVT, some of them have minor change updates as well, which is pretty significant. And then Toyota as well, the new Corolla, I believe, is using a CVT. Mm-hmm. So.
Yep. Subaru's got one. I think we're going to see a lot more CVTs. Yeah. What's the customer feedback, though, especially as you get into a full-size car like the Maxima?
In terms of CVT or just in the...
Right.
The CVT, for current Maxima customers, honestly, a lot of them say that they didn't know it was a different transmission. I mean, just being very candid. Now, from a performance standpoint, we have had customers say, you know, I'd really like the step shift type feel, and that's what they really liked with this. You know, we have had customers take the car, you know, for a drive and made observations from it. And one of the things that they've all said is, wow, I really like the smoothness of this transmission. Sometimes they don't know exactly the technology behind it, but they like the way it performs. And so that's been positive feedback so far. And from our standpoint, we're still able to use the benefits of it, which is getting great fuel economy out of it and the performance as well, the gearing-wise.
Yeah. And it's interesting, is I look at the roof line of this car, it's very coupe-like.
Yeah.
And you were talking about, you know, some of the other full-line competitor or full-size competitors, excuse me. And this would seem to me to be in some ways controversial. Did you get any reaction that people's like, whoa, look at that, that's not your typical full-size car?
Oh, the whole thing's controversial. The whole car is very...
It's going to be good.
Yeah, and exactly. We want the car to stand out. We wanted the car to shock and awe. Absolutely. So, you know, I think it was Abraham Lincoln that said, right, you can please some of the people all the time or all the people some of the time. And I think that's what we've tried to do with this car. It's our flagship. We wanted to stand out and be an example of what Nissan is. The roof line in particular, it's very angled, very sloped, but a lot of it has to do with the visual trick that floating roof line's playing on you as well. If that was one huge piece of metal, it wouldn't look as raked as it is.
It would look heavy.
Yeah, and so when you get in, you'll see that the rear seat headroom-wise is still fine.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions that I get fairly frequently from readers is that given that it is a sedan that's trying to make a performance statement as well, why didn't you go with all-wheel drive? Was there any thought to that ever? What was the thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did look at all-wheel drive very early in the program. One of the things I was talking about early was that the Maxima does so well in the Northeast market, right? As an example, that's where you'd want to introduce all-wheel drive to gain more share. Some of our competitors have done that. For us, we're already doing really well in those areas with this current setup, transverse front-wheel drive. So the case isn't as strong to adopt all-wheel drive. And of course, sizing the platform and the vehicle and the whole concept to base it around all-wheel drive as well was naturally going to drive up the cost as well. And so it competes in a space where we want to keep it between 30 and 40 in terms of price.
Mm-hmm. This is an all-new car, and that's what takes a lot of effort. And where I'm going with this is this week, Honda came out and announced it's going to add more time to product development.
Mm-hmm.
Ford last year, said the same thing. Hey, we need to add more time. And it's all being driven by all these record number of recalls, mm-hmm. I believe. What about at Nissan? How long did it take you guys to do this car? Or are you looking at adding more time to developing a new vehicle?
This one in particular, we did do in what we consider quick time for us. We probably started this project mid-2011, and you've got the car on sale now. One of the reasons that this project got off to a late start was, of course, we were all coming out of the recession, right? We were all kind of waiting, standing back and saying, hey, where is this market headed? What's the right thing to do? And then, we kicked it off in mid-2011. In terms of our design process, we're always trying to optimize between having the right amount of time, but obviously, shortening it allows us to react quicker, especially, I think, in terms of IT. We're seeing almost IT being its own different development cycle. For example, the vehicle design might be finalized in, November of 2012, with IT not being locked down until September of 2013, right? Because you've got to wait. You've got to, just as you lock something down, you'll get an announcement from Apple saying, well, we're going to do something called CarPlay, and we'd love to see that in the car, or have a new USB standard. And so I think you'll see with IT, that design and development cycle be a lot different than the actual vehicle.
Decoupled from the rest of the car?
Exactly, decoupled.
Wow. Yeah. Can you do that, though? I mean, because this is kind of, CarPlay or Android Auto is kind of the OS for, the operating system for all the telematics, infotainment, and all that. Can you really proceed without having that already baked into the car?
Yes and no. In some ways, you can. What you can do is you can also decouple, for example, the body control module, for example, in the vehicle, not tie that into the infotainment. You lose some of the benefits of that, which is, for example, your HVAC, when you turn the dial, the temperature showing up on your center display. Maybe now your HVAC needs its own unique display. But decoupling that allows you to, again, decouple those development processes as well. So there is always positives and negatives to it.
What's your thoughts on the HMI, the human machine interface.
Mm-hmm.
We see some companies are using like scratch pads, others have joysticks, others have the rotary knobs, others are increasingly going to touch screens with swipe and pinch and all that. What do you think is the best?
Well, what we did for Maxima is we did kind of two approaches. One is we did the pinch and swipe type screens, capacitive touch screen. And we've got that. That works really well for inputting addresses. People are very familiar with touchscreens. All of us have smartphones. Some of us have multiple smartphones. It's something we're very, very familiar with. That being said, we also added a command dial or a display dial. We call it Display Commander on the console. That works really well for certain things, like if you've got a 2,000 or 3,000 song iPod list and you want to scroll through it. You don't want to be hitting down on that display. And you can use voice recognition, but if you want to scroll through the song, you just rotate that knob. It gets you where you need to go, and you hit Enter. Same for zooming in and out of a map. When you're driving, pinch to zoom works phenomenally when we're sitting in a chair like we are now. Driving along a bumpy Detroit road, it might not work as well, right? And so that's why we offer that knob. We just rotate it to the right to zoom in, left to zoom out.
And some companies are finding that one of the keys is having both systems, if you have, you know, multiple controllers, having both of them able to do most of the same things, so you've got duplicate, you know, controls.
Yeah.
Is that what the feedback you're getting from customers too?
That's what we've gotten, and both controls are 100% redundant. So you can choose to exclusively use the touchscreen and never touch that command dial, or just use the command dial exclusively.
And for things like temperature and fan, if I recall correctly, you stuck with, you know, some of the, you know, good old-fashioned toggles and dials.
Correct. Knobs always work really well for adjusting temperature. we haven't found a solution worthy of going to beyond that. But, yeah, we've got a separate HVAC unit with its own display. Very simple to use.
You said the interior is one of your favorite parts of this car. Why?
It's just... You know, a lot of times, at least for me personally, you look at a car on the exterior, there's a lot of wow, and I see the industry in general trying to separate itself with design. And we see midsize sedans that, you know, you take a nameplate from 10 years ago, you're like, oh, okay, whatever. You know, now it's a design masterpiece, or they're really trying to set themselves apart. But the interior, I think a lot of the times that wow doesn't carry over to the interior. And I think with Maxima, we really wanted to change. We wanted you to get in the interior and go, holy moly, like, this is different. And it was just the materials, the inspiration. I mean, our designers and our color design guys were looking at high-end fashion and furniture and all kinds of things to do, you know, to inspire the interior. The engineers were trying to figure out ways to automate a genuine stitch. And so that's why the Maxima has genuine stitching across the dash, the doors, the console. These guys went to Germany. They, you know, found a supplier whose name I cannot begin to pronounce because it's 25 letters long, and got a tool that will do an automated stitch with a genuine thread. And it's amazing. That's part of what makes the interior look so good.
And you guys went to a naval air station? Or?
Yes, we went to the Blue Angels Naval Air Station during development to take a look at their aircraft, get an idea of what it means for a vehicle to be aircraft-inspired, and then try to impart that to the car.
Of course, the manufacturing people must be going, you guys are crazy. Look what you're trying to make us do. Because this can't be easy to build either. This takes some special care, I would imagine.
Yeah, there are certain aspects of it that really push the manufacturing and engineering guys to the limits, such as the body stampings on the outside, just the complexity of it. There's, you know, look at the door. It's moving out, in, out, and
again. Compound curves going in all different directions.
Exactly.
Right.
And then on the interior as well, again, like I said, there was a lot of difficulty around getting that stitching done, and then getting that tool over from Germany over and putting it into our plant or our operation in Tennessee. But that being said, we've also tried to simplify things a bit. We've got 5 grades, for example, no options. So we've really helped the manufacturing and the engineering guys out there, because instead of having 13 different ways to build a car like we did with the previous one, you just got 5. You pick a grade, you pick a color, and you're done.
How does the prospective buyer feel about that?
That's a great question. So I'll give you 20 years ago, I think people went on a dealer lot. Not I think, I know. People went on a dealer lot, looked at a car, and fell in love with it on the lot, right? You'd go, you'd see a blue Maxima and say, God, that's the one I want. I'm in love with that car. Today, over 7 in 10 shoppers, and I think that figure's a little underreported, are shopping online. They go online, they configure the car the exact way they want it, and they fall in love with it online. And then they go to the dealer and say, hey, Mr. Dealer, I'd love to get this car. And if they can't find that combo, they're disappointed. When you have just 5 ways to configure the car and no options, there's a very high likelihood they're going to find that exact car at the dealer, or at least one close by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes the whole sales process a whole lot easier.
Yeah.
Earlier, you were talking about some of the sedans that are really going hot right now. But you're talking, you know, Mercedes, Audi, and the like. Can you seriously get luxury buyers to consider shopping a Nissan-branded car?
It's a great question. I think what we're going to see and what we have seen in the past with the previous car is, one, we see buyers looking at those cars look at us and we intercept them on the way up. That's where we have a lot of strength in the Maxima nameplate to prevent those buyers going to luxury. They can afford it now. They've gone up in their lifestyle and their life age, if you will. And they're saying, I can now afford to spend $40,000 on a BMW 3 Series or an Acura TLX. But my $40,000 gets me a lot more with the Maxima. And so those are the kind of buyers we're going to look at. The second thing is, those are, you know, the Mercedes and the BMWs, they're obviously the tier one luxury brands. But maybe there are some of those Neolux brands that we can pull from as well, where the brand cachet may be not as strong, and we can pull them into Maxima.
Who shops or cross shops? What cars are cross-shopped with the Maxima right now?
Our number one or top three cross shop, put it that way, for a long time has been the Acura TLX.
Interesting.
TL, as it was before, now TLX. And so that's one of our key customers that we're going to be going after, continue to go after with this new car.
Not Toyota Avalon?
The Avalon is not normally one of our highest cross-shops just because their buyer tends to be a lot different than our buyer. That being said, we do see, we'll inevitably see some interaction. But our buyer tends to be very young, more wealthy than the segment, and typically just looking for a more dynamic product.
So that's the sportiness of this car versus what the Avalon historically has.
I think it's
been
the sportiness and styling of the vehicle. Just sportiness in terms of it, dynamic and then styling. Mm-hmm.
This is a much bigger car than the TLX.
Yes.
It's bigger, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's a bigger vehicle.
I would have never thought that would be the number one cross-shop.
Yeah, they shop a lot together. They're both platform-wise, transverse, front-wheel drive-based cars. And in terms of execution, very similar, both athletic, both fun to drive, or pitched that way at least. And so we do see a lot of interaction between the two.
How do your, your colleagues at Infiniti feel about this?
They're thrilled.
Hold that thought. We'll come back to this. We're going to take a quick break right now because we've got to give a shout-out to our good friends at Bridgestone.
Yes, you can.
Okay, we're back. And Gary was asking about how the Infiniti brand people feel about who you're going after with this car.
I think so. Your question is what's Maxima's impact on Infiniti? Well, Infiniti, obviously, it's a different brand, different customer, different service experience. And that being said, also the price range of the vehicles are very different. Maxima is 32 to 39 and change. The Infiniti start roughly in the mid-30 with the Q50, for example, but goes all the way up north of just around 55. So it's really a very different kind of customer. Obviously, they have more horsepower, a different platform, a different dynamic. So in terms of cross-shop, we don't expect to see anything different than what we've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. There's obviously some overlap, a little bit of interaction, but not too much.
Oh, come on, just look at that.
So you think there's going to be more?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I agree. The styling is going to attract a lot more attention than the old one.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the things you mentioned with the TLX is that you're bigger, and that's one of the things that I think it's easy to forget about when we look at the Maxima, because there is so much emphasis on style and on a kind of a sporty character. I mean, how big a deal is rear headroom for your buyers? I mean, we think of full-size sedans as frequently being family buyers. You know, that's certainly why, you know, people buy the cubic foot in some of the other, you know, full-size sedans. How does that set of concerns play into the Maxima?
If the designers had their way, this car would be 2 inches lower. But absolutely, it's hugely important. You know, this is a family. I mean, we still call it the four-door sports car, right? And four-door, I mean, the huge emphasis there is on practicality. It has to be something that people can put child seats in the back and take their kids to school and so on and so forth. So it is important to our buyer. We feel confident that we've achieved the right balance of rear seat room, rear seat headroom, shoulder room versus the styling. The buyer still has told us, look, primarily I'm the one driving the vehicle. So I want the focus to be on me and the style and the emotion that I get from the vehicle and project with this vehicle. That being said, it needs to be practical. So there's a balance between the two. We didn't feel the need to go dramatically on the sort of normal full size end of the spectrum and deliver a very tall roof line that doesn't give us the styling and the packaging that we want.
And talking about, you know, sort of lower luxury, entry luxury brands where there's interplay, Acura obviously, you know, plays there. Buick has been trying to establish itself in that space. Have you seen more interplay between the Maxima and any Buicks over the last couple of years, or are they still sort of an outlier?
We've seen a little bit of interaction with LaCrosse. I mean, that kind of falls into that sort of full-size luxury type scale. But again, the LaCrosse buyer, a little bit more aligned with the Avalon buyer there, a little bit tends to go for a bit more sedate style and driving dynamic than this. But there's a little bit of interaction. I'd also actually add that, you know, when it comes to cross-shop, one of the other things we're seeing is the what you call, you know, the traditional, the lower mid-size sedans, right? Your Altimas and your Camrys and Accords, those are starting to creep up in price. Some of those are now mid-30s, even high-30s, fully loaded. We expect to see a little bit of interaction there, too, where now there's not as distinct an overlap or a distinct separation, I should say, between those Camrys and Accords and Altimas and these full-size sedans. With them encroaching up in terms of price, you're going to see those buyers start to look at this and go, well, I'm getting a lot, you know, maybe a lot more for my money, a nice, much nicer interior, much higher level execution, and I'm not going to be confused with a guy who's driving around in a $22,000 base model, right? So that could be that is one of the opportunities we see as well.
So we've got some questions here from the audience. Armand wants to know, any chance that we'll see a plug-in Maxima?
it would be an interesting proposition, wouldn't it? I don't think we'll see a plug-in Maxima simply because it's not something the customers are in this space are really asking for right now. They're looking for performance and style, and right now a plug-in just doesn't really fit with that mold. But that's not to say if the...
Never say never, right?
Exactly. If the demand isn't there, we wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Mike Ma wants to know, can you really sell this car as a sports sedan with a CVT instead of an 8-speed automatic or a dual clutch?
I don't fault Mike one bit for his question. I'd say that Mike should definitely go out and drive the vehicle. I think there's a perception that CVTs can't be fun, that CVTs cannot be sporty. And I think with this vehicle, we really feel very differently about it. We think that with the programming and with the right sort of hardware to back it up, it can be a very, very good complement and an enhancer to the experience.
And I would back up what you just said, because I did get the chance to spend part of an afternoon in one of the cars and had no issues with the CVT whatsoever in the way it operates. Mm-hmm. I'm not even saying, you know, a fault in it. Let's see. We got a question here from Mighty Max, who says, I drove a brand new Maxima where the driver door panel would move significantly when the window was down. Are there any initial quality concerns for the new Maxima?
There are none so far, but the car has been on sale for just over a month. A lot of attention has been paid to make sure that, again, if you are going to compete with those, let's say, entry luxury cars, as an example, you've really got to have the quality just dialed in just right. One of the things that makes those doors particularly heavy and is those they're full of laminated glass, so the windows in the front are made of laminated glass, and so that glass itself has a lot of rigidity. The moment it moves to the top, it can actually significantly change the rigidity of the structure itself. But that being said, yeah, no concerns so far.
Good. And one last one here, which is really more of a comment than a question. It's from AAH Guest 565, who says, my wife has driven the last five generations of Maxima.
Wow.
She actually test drove a 2016 this morning. It appears a new one is on the horizon.
Very, very
good. So that's pretty good endorsement, you know.
Fantastic.
Somebody with five generations would know in a second whether this was, you know, true to the old ones.
Mm-hmm. We're glad to hear that.
So how do you measure success for the Maxima? If we were talking a year from now, what would you say you feel really good about with this vehicle?
I'm sitting on a beach in Costa Rica. I think we've won that one. No, I think success for the Maxima is twofold. One, it's got to do something for our brand. It's our flagship sedan. A lot of the times, Maxima's awareness has been just as high as the Nissan brand, if not higher. Everybody knows somebody that owns a Maxima, and I found that just working on the Maxima program. It seems like it's a huge nameplate for us. And so as long as this can be a true flagship and make people say, wow, what's coming out of Nissan really excites me. They've got something really good going. I think that's one of our goals. And the second one is obviously a sales success, maybe outperform some of its key competitors, especially in terms of retail sales, which is where we care about, what we're really focused on, and get that entry-level luxury cross-shop because of the quality buyers that we want to keep in our brand and have them continuing to buy Maximas and Pathfinders and Altimas for their kids and whatever else.
And along those lines, the sales success, it's beginning to appear like full-size sedans is becoming a segment that's very driven by newness and by fashion, like coupes used to be. Mm-hmm. Whoever's the new hot model has a couple of good years, and then they sort of trail off. Is that something that is inherent in the nature of this segment these days?
I can't say that we've seen that as much with Maxima. I can't speak to some of those other models, but I will say that it is a segment that's driven partly by emotion. And so I think you've got to do things to keep the car fresh. And, for example, special editions or ways to really keep that the car top of mind and really keep it unique and again, emotional buy.
You know, we had the new Murano in the studio a couple months ago, I think it was.
Earlier this year.
And, you know, beautiful styling, the interior. I mean, some of the materials on the interior of the Murano are just extraordinary. So somebody goes into the showroom, they look at the Murano, they look at the Maxima. So given that this is your baby, why are they going to be drawn to this rather than to your colleague's other car?
Well, I would say both products were designed just across the hall, so we had some good-natured ribbing. Obviously, two different segments. If you're looking for a crossover, you're looking at a Murano, and you're not going to get the same level of dynamic thrills as you would with a Maxima. And plus, the Maxima team's just better. So,
you know, if you go back some time ago, Nissan's strategy was sort of a pincer movement around the Accord and the Camry. So the Altima was just below them, the Maxima just above them. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be the strategy anymore.
Not at all, no. That changed completely with the 2002 Altima, if you remember, with the clear taillights and the big, at the time, brawny V6 that made a colossal 240 horsepower when, you know, everybody else was churning out 190 or whatever. It changed completely. We went from being, you know, one of the smallest, I believe, midsize sedan to the largest in terms of overall length. We were right there with the Accords and the Camrys and the packaging, and that allowed this to move up market. And that's what we repositioned the car in 2004. We knew we would take the volume down, but really position the car upward to get that even higher quality customer and that positioning and do some more unique things with the car.
Well, Vishnu, it's been awesome having you on here. The music is the cue that this segment is winding down right now. But thanks so much for coming on the show and bringing your baby with you.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you guys having us on the show. And hope you continue to enjoy the car and take it for a drive.
Real good. Thank you.
Fantastic.
We could tell you about the years of research and development, how we forged advanced high-strength steel to make the frame stronger yet lighter, the countless hours spent testing the suspension and tuning every sound from the engine to the trunk. But until you get behind the wheel, you have no idea. The completely redesigned Hyundai Sonata.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
Of course, we want to thank Hyundai and Henkel for supporting this program, but it's cool. I love being able to get, you know, product planning people who really know the industry, know their mm-hmm. segment, know their vehicle. It's a great way to do it.
Loves his team.
Loves his team, right? Yeah. That's going to stir up some controversy. Uh-huh. He's going to hear about that. Uh-huh. And, you know, we should talk about next week, too, because we're going to have the BMW i3 here, and John Kelly from BMW... I think he's the product manager for right. BMW North America. So,
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and I think many of the after-hours viewers remember we had Sandy Monroe on talking about the i3 and basically positioning that car as being the Model T of the 21st century. So I think that this is a great opportunity next week to learn about, you know, some of the inside from the OEM side rather than from a supplier looking at it.
Yeah,
and people talk all the time about a clean sheet of paper, but that's very seldom the case.
Right.
The i3 is
totally
clean sheet. Of paper.
That's about
they
as clean sheet as
every
you can.
Rule.
Yeah.
Or clean sheet of carbon fiber.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see what he's got to say about Sandy's report, too. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he's read it.
Yes, I'm sure he has. So, of course, you know, we always have to do these interesting numbers now.
And what you got this week?
So, you know, with the situation in Greece being in the news this week, I decided that I had to take a look to see how sales were doing in Greece. And so So far this year, it actually isn't too bad over there.
You're
in
kidding.
Terms of car sales.
I would have guessed that sales are dead.
Well, last month they were down a bit, but so far this year they're positive. So if we look at the sales numbers of the cars that have been sold in Greece so far this year, in 2015 it's 40,000 and change. Okay, and last year it was 37,000 and change. So basically, they're up 7.4% this year.
That's stunning.
It's very stunning. But then what I found something that was even more stunning was the fact that I thought, okay, let's find the country in Western Europe that has fewer car sales in Greece. And there's only one country that has fewer car sales.
Portugal.
Nope.
Ireland.
Luxembourg.
Okay.
So Luxembourg sold, so far this year, about 25,000, 25,500. Okay, so that's the comparison to the 40,000 that sold in Greece. But then I looked at the population of Luxembourg versus the population of Greece. So the population of Greece is basically 10.7 million. Uh-huh. The population of Luxembourg is 520,000.
Oh, my gosh.
So basically, you know, you're looking at about like a 5% difference there.
And a much richer sales
5%.
Mix.
I bet. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, there's a whole lot more money over there, and they're probably not worried about a euro crisis in Luxembourg.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you looked at these numbers, because I also looked at GDP and found out that the total GDP, or the full economy of Greece, is only slightly larger than that of the state of Michigan.
There you go.
And with nearly a million more people, mm-hmm. their whole economy is not a whole lot bigger than Michigan's. So that to me, helps really put it in perspective.
Well, and amazingly to me, the ACEA, the European Automakers Association, I think just today revised their sales outlook for the year upward, mm-hmm. which with all of the angst that's going on about whether, you know, the Greece stays with the euro or not, I would never have expected mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. Well, that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. That's a great sign for the industry in Europe, because we all know they desperately need to get sales back on their feet again.
So especially with China in turmoil all of a sudden, too. Mm-hmm.
And Brazil.
Yep.
Yeah. And Russia. Yeah. The BRICS have sort of mm-hmm. kissed BRICS.
Yes, they have.
Hey, Mark, you're working on a real interesting story.
Oh, this was so much fun. It's my Sunday column, and we got some great photos that go with it. In 1915, Edsel Ford and five of his boyhood buddies went on a cross-country road trip. Edsel drove a Model T. The names are all famous. They'll be recognizable to anybody from Detroit. That's Edsel's Model T getting ready to leave what was then the Ford Farm in Dearborn, because the Fairlane Estate didn't exist yet. And you'll note that there's a rifle scabbard sticking up out of the spare tire. It's because there were highwaymen and wild animals all along the route. They camped out. They tied the tent supports to the side of the Model T sometimes. And they just had a great time. It was a bunch of really prominent young men who were about to go into the family business and have the rest of their lives planned for them. This was the first sort of post-school road trip. We got a picture here of them axle deep in the Model T and mud. That's what the roads were like. They took, amazingly, much of what would eventually be Route 66, you know, the old Santa Fe Trail.
Not the Lincoln Highway.
No, they took westward, they took mostly the Santa Fe Trail, Lincoln Highway. They drove up the coast in California to San Francisco, where the World's Fair was taking place, and where Ford Motor Company had put up a satellite Model T plant to show people what a moving assembly line was like. They built like 9,000 Model Ts on the site, and they came back, some of them, via the Lincoln Highway. That's less well documented. All the photos we were just looking at, Edsel took himself. Well, Edsel is standing there. He's the guy leaning on the car.
It's a selfie.
He did not take that. But there's hundreds of photos. He was a really good photographer, too. And he put together a scrapbook for his five buddies. That's Edsel. They were goofing off. They stopped at this sort of mysterious European countess's ranch in Colorado, and they spent 3 days goofing off, and you know, they're striking cowboy poses. There's pictures of them playing with six guns and stuff. It's a bunch of young guys being young guys. That's Edsel. He just climbed up on top of a rock for some reason. You know, we know so little about him because he had such a short life, and his father, was so domineering in so many ways. And this is just a really kind of appealing, look into him as a guy. Mm-hmm. You know, within within 2 years, you know, of these photos, he'd be married, president of the company, you know, second child on the way. This photo is great. That's the Model T on the way up a long, steep hill in Colorado. The car couldn't make it, so at the bottom of the hill, they stripped out the cushions, the tools, the tents, everything. They were able to drive the stripped Model T up the hill, and they hand-carried all of that wow. stuff to the top of the hill and put it back in the Model T at the end. But, and that does not speak all that well of the Model T, you'd think. Two of his friends were driving as well. There was a Stutz and a Cadillac 8-cylinder, so a couple of really high-end cars. And according to Edsel's journal notes, at least, the Model T was by far the most reliable. The other two, you know, spent a lot more time down for repairs, but everybody was repairing stuff all the time.
That was the norm for the day.
Exactly. They were carrying 8 spare tires a day at some point.
You know, I'd like to run back through a couple of those pictures real fast, Ben, if you could go to that first one. Because I noticed the wheels. Look at those bicycle spokes. I've never seen that before.
That was a new custom wire wheel that somebody at Ford did that they wanted to experiment with. And if you scroll forward a couple, see the wire wheels are still there.
But
the next one, I think, it's wooden spokes.
Yeah, those are the ones I'm familiar with.
Yeah, the wire wheels were not surviving. So they stopped at Ford dealers in a lot of towns along the way. And they would have parts expressed to them and things like that. So I would imagine at some Ford dealer, from the looks of the landscape, you know, maybe in Kansas, they decided they were just going to give up on the wire wheels, and they went back to the wooden spokes. So, good eye.
How long did this adventure last?
God, I think it was about almost a month, because they took their time. Edsel, really meticulous logbooks, entries for every day, every gas, every fuel tank, he noted. And it was 4,202 miles, and he averaged in the Model T, 17.5 miles a gallon. Hmm. And starting next week from Detroit, a week from Friday, the Historic Vehicle Association, the president, Mark Gessler, and their chief historian are going to recreate the trip in a just restored 1915 Model T.
Wow.
They're going to leave Fairlane, which is now, where they were standing was going to be the site of Fairlane in that first photo. They're going to leave the Fairlane
being the Ford estate.
The Ford estate, yes, I'm sorry.
Where Henry built his house.
Yes,
that's still there today.
Yeah, so they're going to leave the driveway of the estate, drive cross country. They've got a couple of new Fords that will be their follow vehicles. So they're still probably assuming a fair number of spare tire replacements.
Mm-hmm. This is a cool story. I've never heard anything about this before, ever.
No, it's amazing.
Not that I know everything that Edsel Ford ever did in his life, but I've never heard of this.
And the photos are just so great. Like I said, this is him being a guy. You know, and it's not a picture that we have of Edsel.
Yeah, but it's interesting. We always see the pictures of his old man, with Harvey Firestone and,
Thomas
Edison.
Burroughs.
Yeah, and they're all doing this stuff, but never the son. I think that Edsel is probably one of the most overlooked individuals in the history of the auto industry. And is probably more beneficial to the auto industry than a whole lot of people.
Look, to your point, Mark, Henry was very domineering. He made Edsel president, but he didn't really let him run anything.
Yeah.
I think if Edsel had really been left to run the company, it'd be Ford that was number one and not General Motors.
Every position he took in retrospect appears to have been the right one,
Yeah. Real car guy. Hey, we're going to take another quick break right now, and we got to give a shout out to our good friends at Fiat.
All-new Fiat 500X crossover, featuring an available Uconnect system with a 6.5-inch touchscreen and available all-wheel drive. Well-rounded, has never looked so sharp.
It's a great commercial.
So we were just talking about Edsel Ford and his trip, but I might have cut you off, Gary. You got Dr. Data? Have you more data?
Well, this is just a sort of an interesting picture. So as you guys know that the underground workers in the city of London went on strike today.
Underground meaning subway workers.
It's a tube.
In American language, right.
And so the folks at TomTom came up today with an image showing the traffic jam in London. So Ben, if we can show that, and Well, maybe we can't show that. Ah, there we go. So there's a 23-mile traffic jam in London today because of this strike. And you think about, you know, that here's this city that is trying to basically has that congestion tax. So to reduce the number of cars. Now, can you imagine what that would be like in any other city in the world, perhaps, you know, that doesn't have that sort of a thing? So it's like a really bad case of measles there.
Well, I lived in London for a while, and I happily never drove a car within the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, without the underground running, you might as well just stay home.
Hey, we got a phone call in, not for our guest Vishnu, but directed at us. Ben, let's bring that phone call in.
This is Clem Zarofsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. I noticed quite a few new cars have this flat, upright grill, plus those little projected winglets on below the bumper. I understand this is all done for pedestrian protection. Is that true? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So anyone, I got plenty to say. Why don't you guys?
There's a lot, obviously, being done for pedestrian protection now. The most obvious stuff often is more in the profile of the hood, where the hood is raised a little bit so that there's some crush space in case your head goes cracking into it, so that it's not, you know, hood and then immediately engine block. I think some of what we're talking about may be aero things as well.
It is aero, but he does have a point. Part of it is almost like a cow catcher to scoop up your legs, to fling you on the hood, and it is true that
it bounces off the hood.
Yeah, that a more upright grill helps this whole process. But I'd like to see data that supports all this, because I remember being at Fiat's safety lab a few years ago, and they were showing me exactly what you're talking about. You know, the hood that can crush. In fact, they had an airbag that would sort of pop the hood up to give even more crush space. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. Does this really help people? And they said, oh, yes, it does, until they roll off the hood and hit their head on the ground and get killed. So I'd like to see.
The car runs over them.
What's the data to support whether this is really working or not? But it's a very good question from our guest. He's basically right. Much of the shape of the front end today has got to do with pedestrian protection.
Well, last week we mentioned at the top of the show that we were in Germany driving some cars, and we were driving cars that would avoid pedestrians being hit by the cars automatically.
Most of the time.
Well,
there's still some glitches. Yeah, Gary and I were in Berlin, Potsdam, actually, last week with ZF, celebrating its merger or its buyout of TRW. And I was actually impressed at how quickly ZF is incorporating TRW's technology.
So these are two supplier companies, one German company, one an American company. One has a big office just within spitting distance of the studio here.
Right.
And one with big in brakes and steering and sensors, and one big with chassis and transmissions and other powertrain elements. And boy, they, as you say, they have come together quickly.
And the idea is to make cars that are safer and do remove driver error and even pedestrian error
all
from
the
equation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. You know, ZF's been around for a long, long time, 100 years.
100 years. Celebrating the anniversary this year.
And they said, okay, how do we make sure we're here for another 100? Because they're privately held. They're essentially owned by
the
town of Friedrichshafen in Germany. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the town depends on us so much. How do we make sure that we're here for another 100 years? So they said, okay, here's our strategy. Anything to do with CO2 reduction, we ought to be in that. Anything to do with safety, that's a booming area. We should be in that. Anything to do with automated driving leading to autonomous, that's a big thing. We got to be it. And then they went, we're only in the CO2 stuff with our transmission. We may not be here for another 100 years. We better go out and acquire that technology. So they looked at, let's grow it up. It's homegrown, right? And then they went, whew, we're so far behind, it'll take us decades. So then it was, let's go out and buy bits and pieces. And then it was like, wow, what an organizational nightmare to put it together. So then they went on a search, found TRW, went, this is brilliant, just buy the thing and integrate it.
And now they're the third biggest supplier in the world.
Right.
So
and maybe the second, depending on how sales go. But.
And they have a really good history of being a technical leader in the areas that they're in. So it's going to be, I think, fascinating to watch how do the pieces put together. You know, does the whole become more than the sum of the parts?
The other thing I find fascinating is the three biggest suppliers in the world right now are German. And probably the next three are Japanese, you know, Denso, Aisin, and the like. And, you know, if you go back to the 1990s, it was the American suppliers. They were rocking and rolling in this business on a huge M&A, you know, mergers and acquisitions binge. And it didn't work. You know, they leveraged themselves, i.e. went into huge debt to make all these acquisitions. Voila, here comes the Great Recession. Everything collapses. Most of them go bankrupt. And now it's the Germans and the Japanese who are dominating it. Companies that take a much longer view are not Wall Street financed, don't try to close the books every 3 months and report what their numbers are. I think there's a real lesson in that.
Well, it was also, I would argue that they basically stuck to what they were good at doing, and they just focused on that rather than, you know, going far afield and thinking, oh, if we have this, this will make us even more desirable from our OEM customers. And these guys just sort of just kept at it.
Yeah, but I don't even think the Americans did it for their OEM customers. They did it for their shareholders, of which management would share in brilliantly, you know, once all the riches poured in, which never happened. And again, I think there's a real lesson in this. And that's why I'm increasingly worried about whether or not American companies, you know, publicly traded with Wall Street investment, being able to compete when you have to make long-term investments. I'm not sure it can be done.
Well, and, you know, the I think number one and two in the list of suppliers in the world that you were talking about, Bosch and ZF, both owned by charitable foundations, basically.
Isn't that amazing?
And so they inherently are supposed to think long-term, and it's worked out for them.
Hey, I just got a signal that we've got another phone call here. Let's bring it in.
Hi, this is Dennis in Indianapolis. I'd like to ask a question about autonomous cars. Will they be able to pass slower cars on the road? And will autonomous cars break the speed limits ever? Just like to know. Thank you. Love the show.
Thanks for the question.
Well, there was a system that ZF is working on because as you mentioned they're taking this step by step approach to autonomy. They're not going to say, you know, we're automatically going to have this sort of thing. And so what they're working on is that you'd have a 360 degree sensor array whereby you would put your turn signal on, indicating that you want to change a lane because you may have a car that's ahead of you. So you're involved in the process, right? And then it would see if there's any vehicle there, and then it would move over, and then it'll speed up, and then you could do the same thing on the way back. I suspect that this would then be readily automated entirely. So I think we're going to see that. And the future isn't going to be that far away.
Yeah, I'll bet you $1,000 that they will be able to pass slower cars ahead of them. The speed limit question is really interesting.
That's the big
Mercedes just really released a fair amount of information about the safety and autonomous stuff that will be in the next generation E-Class. And it appears that you can tell it to follow the database for what's the speed limit in the area where you are and not exceed it. Or maybe you can even program it to exceed it by a certain amount. And that's going to be very interesting because I think most of us have our cushion that we think I can safely go many miles an hour over the limit. Will you be able to program an autonomous vehicle to do that?
In this town, you drive the limit. Everybody's passing you,
right.
Even the garbage trucks. But I think autonomy will allow you to exceed the autonomous cars will allow you to exceed the speed limit only when passing another car, not on a 4-lane highway, but on a 2-lane road. If you got to get out and pass, sure, you know, you want to get it over and done with and back safely in your lane. So I think autonomy will probably allow you to exceed the speed limit for passing situations. But that's going to be the only one because, you know, today, you drive the car, you're liable for what happens to it. When you get to autonomy, it's going to be the automaker that's going to be liable for it. And so those autonomous cars are going to have to obey every single rule of the road, and that means never exceeding the speed limit.
And one of the capabilities that they have is reading signs. So if you see 55 or 70, they see 55 or 70, and then that is part of the parameters that determines how fast it's going.
I will bet you a much smaller amount than I did on the
passing. Wait, $1,000 for passing?
And I'll bet you a slice of pizza that people will be able to override and tell them to drive at higher speeds.
Well, you know, you could be right, Mark, but there's going to have to be something that says, you know that this is not the law, you have to authorize it and accept all liability as of that.
You're going to have to accept all the responsibility yourself. No,
because otherwise, boy, we're going to need hackers.
Yeah.
Because there's no way I'm just going to sit in the car going, you know, the city speed limit.
No.
Like I said, nobody in this town drives the speed
limit. But theoretically, with more autonomous vehicles, traffic will be smoother and faster anyway. So that will offset if there is a, you know, lowering in the peak speed you can make. Because we've all seen the idiot who drives past you on the right at 95 miles an hour, and 5 miles later...
You calling me an idiot?
5 miles later, you're right behind him again because traffic just wouldn't let him go that way.
Mm-hmm. Or the worst are the people who go flying past you, and then 5 minutes later, they're going five under.
Yeah, oh, God.
And it's like, those are the people that drive me up the wall.
So we got an email this week from Goat Rope, who was, because we sales numbers came out last week, and we obviously weren't here last week, so we didn't do the numbers, and Goat Rope pointed out that the Cadillac ELR and Dodge Viper both had June sales of 62. Wondering whether there was a buy one, get one deal. Did you guys hear anything about that?
No, I hadn't seen that at all.
So 62. So then I looked and I thought it was even more bizarre is that Maserati sold 50 coupes and they sold 50 spiders and convertibles. Exactly 50, 50.
That's not a real number.
And then
that's
not retail. Then I discovered that Volvo sold 5,985 cars in June of 2015, that's only one more car than they sold in June of last year.
Yeah.
What are the odds of that? One car?
One car. Yeah. Well, you know, same damn lineup pretty much,
except
right?
Except the XC90.
But it's
as they get more supply of that
their sales are going to go up
20%.
I just finished test driving one, and everywhere I went, people were like, what is that? Oh, that looks beautiful. I mean, mm-hmm. they loved it. So.
And it's a good value as well, I thought. I mean, a really impressive vehicle.
I don't know. The one I had was $66,000.
Probably the same car, but if you compared it to an X5 or anything
else, I see what you mean, right.
You're paying 20 grand less than you would for the BMW. Yeah.
Right. All right, so who's heard of a vehicle that has gone up 19,100%?
In terms of sales?
Mm-hmm.
19,000.
Alpha 4C.
No.
Damn.
It's close. The Golf R.
Ah.
So they sold 192 last month, and previous year they sold one.
And I happen to be driving one of them at this moment.
Do you?
That is a fun little car.
Yeah?
Yes, yes. Very Germanic and very understated, I think, for a car that's going up against, theoretically, Evos and WRXs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not showy at all. The engine note, you could almost ignore if you wanted to, but it is fun to drive.
So stealthy, but...
Quite stealthy,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What else, Gary? What else you got there?
So what did you guys make of the Auto Pacific Vehicle Satisfaction Awards? That they looked at people, real consumers, and so they said the top luxury car is the Kia K900.
I like that car. Oh, my gosh. I like that car a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what was the sales on that? 64?
And how do you define luxury car if you're going to include Kia, frankly?
Okay,
maybe we can't find it. Maybe it's...
I would say their sample size isn't the largest.
Let's see. They sold 168 in June, and they sold 710 so far this year.
And you have to figure anybody who spent that much money on a Kia is very committed to the proposition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, what was interesting that came out of this was that, so in terms of midsize, large car, Kia Cadenza, midsize car, Hyundai Sonata, compact car, Kia Soul, tied with the Volkswagen Jetta and Beetle. It's a little surprising. But so we have these Korean brands now that are doing so very well. And I was, because I recalled that, you know, if we go to the J.D. Power initial quality study, you know, Kia came in second to Porsche. I mean,
and then
Hyundai came in number four. So it was Porsche, Kia, Jaguar, Hyundai. I mean, it's just like, what's going on here? I mean, you drive a lot of cars.
It's really interesting. I'm a little baffled by it, I have to say, because I think Hyundai themselves are a bit disappointed by their most recent, you know, new car, the Sonata that they introduced last year. Yeah, the sales. And the last couple of Kias I've driven are very good. I would not say that they are. I would not rate any of them as the clear-cut number one in their segment. Mm-hmm. They're just good.
Right.
So I'm a bit baffled by it.
I'm not baffled in the sense that if you remember going back a decade ago, Hyundai and Kia both were on this expansion binge. I mean, they were building plants all over the place, expanding all over the world, China, India, Kazakhstan, of all places. And then all of a sudden,
at work there.
You know, the CEO, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head, said, hey, we're growing too fast. Things are getting out of control here. Put a full stop on everything. Now we have to concentrate on boosting our quality because we're getting our teeth kicked in. You know, we're losing. They had achieved a pretty good quality reputation. When they went on this expansion binge, they started to lose it. And then he said, now we just have to concentrate on quality. No more plant building. Stop it all. Concentrate on quality. So when I hear these numbers, that's what I'm thinking. This is a result of that effort.
So the message here then is build a quality car and you will achieve.
And you'll get good accolades, but sales might suck. that's the conundrum, right? The new Sonata is down, improved over the other one, but it's not selling like
down 9.9% for the year so far.
Mm-hmm.
And they think it's purely styling, which I think is, I'm not sure what the problem is, but it's not just styling.
I think they're right. I mean, you know, the last generation car was truly a styling statement. A lot of swoops and swerves. And you know, when you're a challenger, and that's definitely what Hyundai is, trying to challenge cars like the Accord and the Camry, and you got to do something to stand out, and they did, and it worked brilliantly in the United States. It was a flop in Korea. And the Korean management said, hey, no more expressive styling, we got to dial this back. And they did, and I'm telling you, the new Sonata is a better car in every way, shape, and form except the styling, and it's not selling like it did.
Well, and the next thing they've got coming up is the new Tucson, which I think is really intriguing. It should be a strong player in a really hot segment. I'm going to be driving it next week in Minneapolis with your producer, Chip, and that's one that I believe was designed primarily in Europe. So I'm going to be very interested to see how that is and what the customer response to it is, because Hyundai and Kia both, but especially Hyundai, they just desperately need more SUVs. That was their biggest disappointment last year. They're excluded from the hottest growth segments because their stuff is old or they don't have a player at all.
Yeah, no, I keep pointing out the crossover segment is growing five times faster than the rest of the market.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not playing there, you're losing out on a massive area of growth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hey, look, we're at the top of the hour here. We ought to wrap it up, but Mark Phelan, thanks so much for coming in.
Always fun. Thank
and
you.
And awesome digging up that story on Edsel Ford. That was pretty cool.
The Historic Vehicle Association put it all in my lap, and I'm grateful to him. It's a great story.
And Gary, we'll talk BMW
i3
next
John
week.
Kelly.
That's right.
Should be great. Looking forward to it.
Cool. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion. Fiat. Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com. And by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at Autoline.tv.